If people just want to take your seats at the back, if there are any left, just rather wonderfully going to overfill the panel. But now we get to talk about politics, hopefully, and investments. But I get to use the two words, or three words rather, which have been sort of very threatening over the past couple of years, Brexit being the first, and also the general election. And how do they impact the investment market, particularly for London when it comes to property? Before we start, let me introduce you to the panel this afternoon. We have on my left, moving down, Stephen Down, who's head of Central London and International Investments at Savills. And then Toby Courtauld, who is chief executive of Great Portland Estates. David Marks, co-managing partner at Brockton Capital. And James Lars, fund manager at Schroeder UK Real Estate Fund. So let's start with a question. Let's really kind of bounce into it. Stephen, okay, it's quite a broad question. What's your view on the market? What should we be looking for? I mean, in terms of are international clients coming to you asking for more opportunities, or are they sitting on their hands in the light of the general election?
Well, the answer to that is they are still coming, as evidenced by some very significant deals recently. One which we were involved in was the Leadenhall building at 122 Leadenhall Street. They are coming, but they're coming from different parts of the world for different reasons, and noticeable by their absence are essentially the domestic buyers, with the UK funds and the REITs sitting on the sidelines at best. One or two are looking at the market, but it hasn't got cheap enough in the market that they want to get into. So 85% of investment turnover so far this year has been done by overseas investors. Since Brexit, or since the referendum, about $5.5 billion has been invested by Asian investors, most notably from Hong Kong. About $3 billion from Europe, with a number of the large German funds buying up assets in the city and the West End. About $2 billion from the Middle East since the referendum, and $1 billion from the US.
This is down to sterling, isn't it, basically, the drop in the value of sterling?
There's a 10 to 20% improvement in pricing if you take into account the currency and where you're coming from. Yes, sterling does help. It's interesting to see who's buying what. The number of deals where there's a 10-year WALT, an unexpired weighted term, 10 years plus, has gone up to 40% of turnover, compared with, say, 2 years ago, where it perhaps was only 13, 14%. The value-add bucket, which perhaps represented about 20 to 30% of buying activity in 2014, has fallen to 10%. So it is about buying long-term secure income for these overseas investors. And that will clearly provide a guide as to where the value add or those that are going to buy for the next cycle are going to be hunkering down. It's going to be in the value add stuff where the buyers are less busy from overseas.
And just one point of clarification, by value add you mean?
Part vacant, short-term leases, that sort of thing.
Fantastic. So, Toby, is it a buyer's market in that sense?
No, it's not. I think it's a market which is, as Stephen has said, still rammed full of overseas money looking to buy this long income. I think sterling is partly to do with it. Just to add to Stephen's point about what's going on here, I think a lot to do with what's happening is that we have had a generation of double-digit compound growth, economic growth, in some markets that didn't exist before, with a large number of people whose future pension funds need investing. And when you think about where you're going to put some of it, it will go into real estate. And when you think real estate, it's going to come here first and foremost, and it might go to New York. It possibly will consider Paris. But, you know, yields in Paris are lower than they are here. So I think it's a bigger picture than simply sterling. But is it a buyer's market at that end of the spectrum, the low-risk, long-income, non-value-add piece that Stephen was referring to? Not really, because there's no value for people like us as a property company to access. At the other end of the spectrum, where there's risk, there's not much being sold. And that's the difficult bit. That's the piece that we need to work on. So it's, by the way, never very easy to buy. Even in 2009, when the market was on its knees, it actually wasn't that easy to buy, then.
So at GPE, what are you doing in that case? Are you sitting on your hands?
So we have been a big, big net seller for the last 3 years. We've taken our financial leverage all the way down to almost a record low, certainly since the 1970s, at 12%. And we've been selling to the sorts of people that Stephen is advising and putting into the buildings that he is selling to. And we have been using the receipts to pay down debt, to finish off developments, and we will sit and we will wait, and we will find the odd bit and piece to buy. But I don't expect us to do serious amounts of acquisitions for a little bit yet.
David, we'll come to you in a second, but just stick with Toby for 1 minute. So you're playing the cycle, which is quite a dangerous game, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think for a property company, as distinct to a long investor, be it private family office, be it quasi-governmental organization,
Schroeder's
whatever,
what have you, yes.
We sort of need to. Our cost of capital is significantly higher than the institutional cost of capital, mid-sixes, let's say, and you can't buy long-dated income streams at 3.5 to 4 and a bit, say, and expect to make a margin over your cost of capital. So we have to play at that riskier end of the spectrum, which means we need to play the cycle, because it's cheap when there's a recession, and it gets more expensive as growth comes our way, and then we go again when you have a downturn. The great question of today, I think, is we've been through a period of extreme volatility for the thick end of two generations.
Yep.
Are the circumstances today slightly different that mean, for example, with bond yields where they are, interest rates where they are, we're in a period of relatively benign real estate returns, in which case it's going to be even more difficult for people like us to buy well, but not impossible.
Benign, but not benign for investors. But let's look at that. David, to ask you a simple question, where are you investing at the moment?
Well, we are a bit like Toby. We are also selling, but we're also investing. So it's, I think, when people say we're net sellers, net buyers, we sort of requote a guy called Howard Marks, no relation to me, he runs Oak Tree out of LA. And he was asked a question about a year or so ago, you risk on, you risk off. And he said, investing is not, it's not like American football where you've got the ball and you're risk on and you're being offensive and you're greedy and you're investing. Or it's not like American football where you don't have the ball and it's all defense and you're selling. He said, it's not like that. Investing is like, he said, soccer, but football, where it's like the ball's whizzing around the midfield and it's like you're doing both at the same time. You know, you're defending what you need to defend asset-wise. You might be selling. Same time, you might be looking for an opportunity, and in a split second, you're investing again. So it's
well,
it's
I'm trying to unpick my my kind of sporting metaphor. So does that mean you're investing or not?
Yeah, we are investing.
What are you looking for? I mean, what are your concerns as well about investing?
Well, the concerns are that the another sporting analogy, kind of, but
Bryce.
excuse me.
Sorry.
The break ball that is Brexit, that was Brexit. Imagine it's the break ball in a game of pool, and you're smashing the ball right into the center of that triangle, and the balls are still whizzing all over the table. And the reality is, politically and macro-wise, the balls are still whizzing all over the table. So sometimes you don't even want to approach the table till, the balls have stopped moving around. But despite the sort of the uncertainty, the macro noise, the volatility, we've got a rule in the office, which is, don't listen to what Trump says, just look what he does, because you drive yourself nuts, looking at the tweets and trying to interpret this, interpret that. But we're looking for long-term demographic change, or, if we're getting a little bit nuanced, long-term psychographic change. So it's not just, the age cohort and the income bracket and disposable income, but it's people's attitudes. What do they want? People want, ultimately, similar things. But they want, there is a revolution going on in office. There's a revolution going on in retail, certainly. Residential needs an entire structural shake-up of monumental proportions as pressures build up and up and up. We're looking to take advantage of all those revolutions and changes, and it boils down to stock selection.
James, that's a neat segue onto you in terms of, for an investor, for an institutional investor, trying to avoid any sporting metaphors, please. But we get into jargon at this point, but are you a bull or a bear when it comes to investing, particularly in the UK at the moment?
I think overall I'm relatively bullish if we talk about London. More with regards to what we can do with existing assets than believing there's fundamentally any value in the marketplace, because I think, as the other guys have said, whether you're the dry vanilla investor taking out the end product, or you're looking to get in and create that product for the end user and investor, pricing isn't attractive across the board. And that's in the more core markets of central London, but also some of the more emerging, what would previously have been considered fringe markets that have now come to the core sort of markets we've been investing in for a while, where there was value a few years ago, but it's more difficult to see now. Probably surprisingly, based on where we were this time last year, we are relatively robust on the underlying occupier markets in the sort of areas that we are invested. And so we are investing in London, but we're investing in the portfolio by adding value to assets in markets such as Hammersmith, Whitechapel, Old Street, Battersea, those sorts of areas where we're at a certain rental price point and with a certain quality of product where we're still seeing strong occupier demand. And I think the other element to that is, whilst there's demand from conventional style occupiers of real estate, we're also seeing increasingly competing uses fighting over the same space. More acutely in some of those emerging areas, but it creates a situation where you've got optionality over your asset management initiatives where you can drive value from. So you underwrite an investment on a certain criteria and principle, but you find that you can do other things with the building. And that is useful from an investor perspective because it allows you to switch horses in the event that one market is maybe not traveling in the direction that you anticipate.
Well, let's continue on that theme and also be quite kind of tangible for people listening to this now. What are the buying signals you're looking out for? Are there any kind of flags, whether it be kind of macroeconomic or domestic? What are the kind of the flags that kind of pop up and you think, right, now's the time to go into the market?
A fairly significant fall in pricing, I think. I mean, that's it. It's whereas you can be confident in investing in assets you've already got, trying to underwrite versus a marketplace where there's not a significant supply of stock and still good demand across the risk curve, and believing that you can drive value from that asset is very, very difficult at the moment.
Let's look at the noise. I mean, David, your point about, we've got to ignore the noise to a large extent, whether it be kind of Trump or Brexit. But is that really the case Stephen, to come to you, for overseas investors? I mean, looking at the domestic market, it must create opportunities, surely.
Overseas, in terms of what's happening at the moment? Well, that's right. I mean, we talked about the currencies being one of those plays, but Dickie Wong, who's vice chairman of CC Land, who bought the Leadenhall building, said at a recent closing cocktail party in the Leadenhall building that they are there for the long term. They are basically taking significant profits that they've built up over the last 5-10 years in their own markets, and they're diversifying, and he is not alone in that. This is a long-term structural move for some of these investors, and London has been the recipient of this capital over and above any other major gateway city for some considerable time, so it's not a one-off. London has been the top of the ranking receipt of this capital for over 10 years, over and above Manhattan, and certainly twice the amount of capital, if not three times the amount of capital, is flowing into London this year than is flowing into Paris, for example. So, and it is all about the things that we talk about, the currency, it's the language, it's the rule of law and everything else. So those things really underpin a lot of that fundamental investment in the market into these assets. They believe that there is a very long-term story. And therefore, the issues that we faced last week, at the end of last week, as painful as they are to us, are really just small ripples in that sort of investment road.
So what in that case, small ripples is what you could have noise. But so what keeps you up at night? What worries you from an investment perspective?
The cycle is a cycle. The market comes and ebbs and flows, so let's not fool ourselves. It tends to run a 6 or 7 year pattern.
And where are we on the cycle?
Well, in some cycles we've been in that I've experienced, we've had a proper bust. In others, we've had more of a damp squib, and I think that this is going to be, I think the downside on this is going to be boringly slow and quite stable. I can't see any real trigger point that is going to propel us to the levels of values pricing that we saw post-GFC, for example. So where are we? We're a sort of an extended late cycle play. And interest rates being as low as they are is maintaining that sort of stability. So I don't see, unfortunately, the sort of deals that James and David and Toby want to do coming across their table anytime soon if they're looking at that pricing point of 2010, 2011. But you've just got to, you've got to think about that environment and where, as they all are, the new markets are emerging and where the demographic wants to be and where the workers want to be. And I think that looking into that over the next 2 to 3 years will actually open up even more sub-markets, not necessarily in the traditional cores, but in zones 2 and zone 3.
Toby, I'll come to you one second, but David, I see you nodding at this. I mean, the comments were boringly slow and quite stable and an extended late cycle play. You've been nodding along to that. Would you agree with its entirety?
Yeah, well, the danger, but also, if you like, it is an opportunity, is if you believe in QE infinity, some economists are calling it, is you can't get out of the trap of low interest rates. You know, you can see an extended run of asset prices where, you know, there is a significant premium over the relevant gilt, which is, you know, as of yesterday was sub 1%, the 10-year, UK 10-year. You know, German 10-year Bund is 0.2 something. I mean, it's an incredible margin, even if you're putting in place even a reasonably prudent conservative capital structure. The running return on a reasonable credit WALT is significant. In fact, it's so significant that there is, you know, this rush of capital that Stephen's been describing finds it utterly compelling, because if you sit on the sidelines for more than a few years when target returns are being achieved by other investors and you yourself are not investing, you know, again, that has a compounding effect, and you look up 2-3 years later, you're 3-0 down. So, sorry, it's another sporting
analogy. I was going to say, hang on. I think we've been here before.
I don't know if the FT does sport.
But it's not a game of two halves when you charge.
So, you know, certainly asset prices continue to remain strong given that spread. But that doesn't mean there aren't pockets and sectors where it's not boring and stable and setting up the capital structure and then just clipping a half-decent double-digit ROE. But there are also sectors within the economy that are growing very rapidly. So
we'll come on to that in a second. Okay. Let's stick with the negative for a second. And just in one sentence, I mean, as I asked Stephen, in terms of what worries you? What keeps you up? What are the concerns that people should be aware of? And then Toby will come to you.
What worries us is not unique. I think it probably should worry everyone who's investing right now, which is a lack of quality political leadership driving us right off a cliff with a stubborn, hard Brexit, come what may. You know, last week, you know, I don't mind admitting, even though I think someone told me it might be illegal, but I did a spoilt ballot. I just couldn't bring myself to vote for, you know, a party that I'd always voted for, because I just thought it was there was no plan.
Greens aren't that bad.
So I think a hard Brexit would be a disaster, but it seems like the mood is changing.
Toby, in terms of going back to the initial question about looking more broadly, again, back to the points about boringly slow and quite stable, A, would you agree with that? And B, coming on to my later question about what concerns you have.
Can I just pick up on one thing that Stephen was talking about? Because he made the point that the ripples don't really feature in the investment lexicon of your average Asian billionaire who's looking to buy a piece of the West End or whatever. In that context, I think he's probably right. But actually, these ripples really do matter a lot. They matter a lot, because what happens in the investment market is the product, fundamentally, of what's happening in the economy at large. These investors are willing to come here because they perceive a relatively stable, relatively low tax, bit of yield, to David's point about the excess over costs of finance, and an environment in which there is a pro-business, pro-growth policy structure. If that is under question, which it must be at the moment, then I think you have a whole series of different worries and issues that we have to consider, and I think those ripples become rather more substantial. So
systemic risk at that stage.
Systemic risk and you know, willingness for people to actually, and the investment real estate market doesn't matter. That is not the issue. The real issue is job creation, GDP growth, and do people have a real role in a city like this? And if that gets undermined, the investment market's over, and capital is not invested in sheds, you know, infrastructure, it's not put into inventory to creating product in this country. And that's a much, much bigger issue than what happens in the investment market. So I think it's a very, very real issue. And to the second part of your question, what keeps me awake at night, it is the total lack of political leadership that we have in this country. And the fact that we have in the Tory party absolutely no renewal whatsoever. So you have people who have been thoroughly discredited being brought back into the front line. You have the same old names going around the merry-go-round looking for seats, trying to get themselves back into a position. And I'm afraid I think we're rather fed up of that lot. I think we need some renewal. We need some excitement. And this lot...
yes, we're trying to come onto the positives, if there are any.
But I think, finally, for me, that this lot have not learned the lesson now twice, being negative campaigning is never going to win you an election. You need to offer people a vision and something exciting. And this country needs a little bit of excitement, because otherwise we're going to end up with negatives, and we don't want that.
Very fair points. And James, after not quite follow that, as it were, but in terms of looking, from an investment perspective, again, nervousness is the enemy of the investor. Uncertainty is the enemy of the investor. So given the lack of leadership, given the sense of kind of, that we're kind of flailing around, where does that leave the investor?
I think you have to go back to the fundamentals. And clearly there are prevailing headwinds. I mean, there are some existential issues that London has to think about over affordability, demographics, all that sort of thing that might be exacerbated by Brexit, depending on where we end up. But as we stand at the moment, we have still good occupier demand across the sectors, across most of London's geographies, and a lack of decent quality supply. So on the ground, things are still looking okay. Not in every submarket, and some areas have more challenges than others. I think, London has expanded significantly over the last 10 years. It's forecast to continue to do that despite some of those prevailing headwinds. We need new areas to come forward to facilitate that growth, both in office markets, but also to follow some of those trends that we've seen about people wanting to live close to where they work and play and all that sort of thing that we've seen for quite a long time now. And there are markets that are growing up that will do that, facilitated by transport change. And again, it comes back to the political leadership thing. If we don't have that strong guidance in and around London that leads to continued investment in things like transport infrastructure and Crossrail 2 and all these elements that we need to facilitate the growth of areas that are still affordable and can sustain some of that growth. If we don't have that, then London will struggle to continue to thrive in the way that it has.
Well, let's try and move from the nebulous, which I mean kind of strong leadership, to the more tangible, and look at the issues that investors face. I mean, there's a glut of high-end flats, for example, in the residential market at the moment. I'm not entirely sure what the commercial side is doing, but, I mean, are there still opportunities out there for a fund such as your own?
Yeah, absolutely, because I think that some of the challenges that London is facing and that we are facing as a population demographically is starting to feed through into some really interesting investment ideas. So we've been playing around with areas such as lifestyle senior living, where there's a huge demand, untapped potential, and models that are starting to formulate to capture that demand. Co-living, we've been talking about service working and co-working for a long time. Co-living is an extension of a student accommodation style offer for people post-university who are coming to London, have been living in a 3 or 4 bed apartment or house, and it's difficult to justify the expense for what they're actually receiving in terms of quality, but there are models growing up to satisfy that, and those are interesting from our perspective, without a doubt.
Let's build on that then, because we've done the negatives as well. Let's look at the positives, perhaps. And Toby, you were quite kind of vociferous in terms of what's wrong and what needs to change. What's good looking at the markets?
Well, James has actually touched on lack of supply. There isn't very much, and that's a theme that we've been consistently
in the commercial
world. as you rightly point out, in particular the South Bank, there's a swathe of deliveries coming up now and over the next couple of years in the residential space. But in the commercial space, actually, the supply side has been quite well regulated. partly because the finance needed to build stuff, spec, has not been readily available. So that's a positive. But actually, again, the real correlator to rental growth is not supply. It's relevant. The bigger correlator is economic growth and it's job creation. And to that end, actually, London's been doing pretty well. Financial services has been shrinking, as we know, for roughly 10 years. But it's been replaced by TMT businesses, the creative industries, and a whole range of areas around the core of the central London market that have really put themselves on the map. And actually, I think James's point about infrastructure, Crossrail, has been possibly the single biggest good over the last, well, I guess 40 years, frankly, that is now upon us and is unquestionably going to broaden London's appeal to people living further out who can get in more easily. It may well help solve the housing crisis because, not alone, but it will help in that you can live further afield and still get into the capital to work, etc. So there are clearly positives.
Stephen, okay, let's build on that. Crossrail, economic growth within London, does that count also for the UK as a whole, do you think?
From the wider UK, I think it's more difficult in the wider UK. I mean, we've seen turnover drop quite considerably. They don't have that push of money coming in from overseas as much as we've seen in London. So that is a market dominated by predominantly the UK institutions, and certainly anecdotally, post Friday, there's definitely some hesitation over the events of that election decision. And those cycles are softer in the big cities. You know, they're not as dramatic. There aren't the sort of dramatic rental falls, but certainly I think the focus, you know, does tend to come back to London.
Is it all about London in that sense?
I think London is the engine of growth and innovation, and I think that you know, so long as London is doing well, then the rest of the country will do well too. Touching on the sort of the optimistic themes, I mean, yes, Crossrail, Elizabeth Line opening up next year is going to be a real game changer. And it opening up fully in 2019 is going to bring in and create a lot more opportunities for a wider number of businesses and the working population. The rise of the collaborative workspace. WeWork is more than just a reinvented reinvented Regis with skinny jeans and a beard. This is a business that is putting the sort of the incubator business model into that serviced operation. And remember, you know, the take-up numbers that are coming out at the moment that are down, guess what, because that's what the cycle does, only take into account the WeWork and the service office operation occupation. Of course, there's all those businesses that are filling those office buildings, and they are operating at a sort of, in most cases, a 90-95% capacity. So you could sort of double the amount of turnover that's really there if you take into account the space taken by service office operation.